At Pfizer, we are committed to listening to and learning from patients and their care teams so that we can work to help address their unmet needs. From early discovery to clinical trials, through approval and use of our medicines, patients are at the heart of everything we do. Learn more at cancer.pfizer.com.
I'm Greg Dalton.
I'm Arianna Brocious.
And this is Climate One. So, Arianna, we've had a couple of weeks. The election shock is settling in. How are you feeling about it?
Still not great. I'm pretty worried about what the next 4 years are going to mean for climate and for the environment and lots of other things, frankly.
Democracy. Yeah, me too. I think I'm trying to look at bright spots, the technology. There's a lot more EV choices out there. They're more affordable. Induction cooktops in people's homes and kitchens. Heat pumps are gaining traction, more affordable. And these technologies are reducing carbon emissions. And there's also a growing infrastructure in the United States, more factories, more reshoring of manufacturing, building clean energy products.
Yeah, those are all true. I hope those things continue. I think for me, a couple of the things that are really on my mind right now are the longer term ramifications of what the change of administration will mean. And thinking back to the first Trump administration and all the ways that the rule changes and actions that his administration took affected the environment in ways that we still see. So, for example, I live near the southern border. There was this huge push to build this new border wall. And to do that, they destroyed sites that are sacred to Native American tribes. They pumped hundreds of gallons of groundwater in a region that's incredibly arid and dry. And they severed these wildlife corridors that have been there forever. And so, you know, those things aren't going back to the way they were. And I think that's one of the things that concerns me.
Yeah, I'm also concerned about the erosion of institutions that protect our clean air and clean water. And those institutions, once they're damaged, are difficult to rebuild and regain public trust. We know that climate and environment were not top-tier issues in the recent U.S. election. They never are. Immigration, inflation, and other concerns were top of voters' minds, and people chose Donald Trump to address them.
Yeah. And if you care about the climate crisis, it's hard to not feel pessimistic when the incoming president says things like this.
The ocean's going to rise in 400 years, an eighth of an inch, and you'll have more seafront property, right, if that happens. I said, is that good or bad? I said, isn't that a good thing? If I have a little property on the ocean, I have a little bit more property. I have a little bit more ocean.
There's so much going on there. Of course, it downplays the devastation that rising oceans will have on coastal communities in the U.S. and around the world. There's a huge ticking time bomb in the insurance industry driven by rising seas, more severe floods, and fires. And it's hard to see how a government with Donald Trump in charge is going to take any of that seriously.
And we've seen this movie before. The first Trump administration rolled back more than 100 climate and environmental safeguards and withdrew from the Paris Climate Agreement. When Donald Trump again takes office, Republicans will control both the White House and Congress, which many might see as a worst-case scenario for climate policy. So this week, we're going to look into whether or not that's really the case.
Right. It's not black and white or all set. You know, Republicans are speaking up for President Biden's signature climate law that has delivered most of its benefits in the form of billions of dollars and jobs and factories to red districts. One indication of that is when North Dakota Republican Senator Kevin Cramer recently told the Wall Street Journal, quote, there are too many things in there that are too important to too many constituencies to throw out the law.
So we may not see a full repeal, but definitely some parts of it could be weakened. And knowing that, in these last waning weeks of the Biden administration, staff are working very hard to disperse grants and loans to support the clean energy transition before the change of administration. So we'll see what happens there.
Right. I think the EV tax credits are probably going to be first on the chopping block when there's a tax deal, extending the tax cuts. Lots of fights. Let's take a look at all three branches of government and see how climate and energy policy might fare under the second Trump term.
And we'll start with the White House. So for this, we've invited our own political junkie, producer Austin Colon. Welcome, Austin.
Hey, Ariana. Hey, Greg. Thanks for having me on to talk through such a weedy subject.
All right. That's where we bring you in for the weeds. So what moves have you seen the Trump team make that would have the biggest climate implications?
Well, so far, I'd have to say his choices for cabinet are probably going to be the most concrete examples of how the incoming administration will handle climate and energy policy.
Right. There's a saying in Washington that personnel is policy.
Exactly. And it seems like only hours after Trump was declared the winner, there were announcements of nominees for cabinet positions. And some were controversial, like Fox News host Pete Hegseth for defense secretary and Matt Gaetz for attorney general.
Right. And of course, Gaetz eventually withdrew his name from consideration and resigned from Congress.
So there have been some picks that are controversial, even among both parties. But do those really affect climate policy?
Well, that's the interesting thing. For the cabinet positions that affect energy policy, Trump seems to be taking credentials much more seriously. Like, for energy secretary, he picked Chris Wright, CEO of Denver-based Liberty Energy. Wright pretty much laid out his philosophy at a Texas Public Policy Foundation talk about energy poverty.
We're in the greatest energy crisis the world has seen in decades. But this energy crisis has nothing to do with the scarcity of energy. It's about decision-making. Political policies, ill-informed and destructive political decision-making has led us to where we are today.
You know, you've been covering climate for quite a while, Greg. What do you think of Chris Wright and Liberty Energy?
Well, you know, Democrats tend to pick academics often to be Secretary of Energy from MIT or Stanford, you know, and Republicans pick people from industry. So in that line, you know, Chris Wright is very much in line with previous cabinet secretaries. I read the ESG report from his company. I will say I was kind of surprised that his company had an ESG statement. Mm-hmm. It focuses on fossil fuels having lifted people out of poverty, which they have. But it ignores how burning fossil fuels is driving extreme floods, fires, and droughts. It's not really heavy on the science. It's heavy on supply, which you would expect. It also criticizes subsidies for solar and wind while ignoring many subsidies for fossil fuels. You know, it's a fairly mainstream view of a fossil fuel company focused on boosting supply rather than switching to another kind of business or energy source.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of a common thread among most of Trump's picks. For Secretary of the Interior, which supervises the nation's vast public lands where lots of energy and mineral extraction happens, Trump has tapped former North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum.
We also know that we can do things like decarbonize baseload with carbon sequestration. We can decarbonize liquid fuels with carbon sequestration and enhance oil recovery. The answer here is innovation, not regulation. We're in a cold war with China. The way you beat China is with a strong economy. The way you have a strong economy is you innovate, which is what this country has always done, as opposed to regulate, yeah. Which is, you know, both environmentally and financially trying to actually shut down entire industries.
So basically, he's saying he supports innovation to deal with carbon pollution and wants to produce as much energy as possible.
Yeah, and some say he's also in the, you know, all of the above energy strategy camp, though it sounds to me like his heart is still with oil and gas.
Yeah, it's a drilling state that he comes from. So these are people with knowledge of the industry and the ability to put Trump's energy policy into action.
So what about his choice for the Environmental Protection Agency?
So for EPA, he's chosen Lee Zeldin, who ran for governor here in New York and lost to Kathy Hochul. But he did a lot better in a blue state than you'd expect for a Republican to do. He actually does have a history in Long Island of combating toxic chemicals when he was a congressman. And yet, here's what he had to say about leading the EPA.
So day one and the first 100 days, we have the opportunity to roll back regulations. There are regulations that the left wing of this country have been advocating through regulatory power that ends up causing businesses to go in the wrong direction.
Yeah, so that's a pretty big shift, almost a 180 really, from our current EPA Administrator Michael Regan, who's focused a lot on regulations that limit harmful pollutants like soot and particulate matter, mercury and contaminants, and also been focused on reducing methane emissions. Okay, so all these nominees have to be confirmed by the Senate. Austin, how likely is that to happen?
It's basically a certainty. I mean, Republicans only need 50 votes to approve a nominee. They have 53 votes in the Senate, so that's enough to approve nominees without any help from Democrats or even needing the tie-breaking vote by the vice president. And yet, some of these more controversial nominees still might struggle even with that clear majority. And Trump is prepared for that. For those, he's demanded that the Senate Majority Leader, in this case John Thune, allow for recess appointments. A recess appointment allows the president to approve a nominee while the Senate is not in session. The Constitution does allow for this, though the appointment only lasts until the end of the Senate's next session.
Thanks, Austin, for that new cabinet rundown.
Anytime.
Of course, a lot of fights about policy and regulations will end up in the legal system.
Right, and that leads to our look at another branch of government that is going to be affected by the incoming administration, the judicial branch.
So I invited Earth Justice President Abigail Dillon back on the show to talk about this. Her organization brought hundreds of lawsuits against the first Trump administration, and in the years since, they've continued to argue cases before many of Trump's judicial appointees. But before we got into what the second Trump term will mean for some of these cases, she reflected a little on the election result.
I believe in the climate deadlines the scientists are telling us about. And so every year in what we're calling this decisive decade feels so high stakes. And thinking about the lost opportunity to make even faster progress in the United States. And it's not just the United States. As we go, the world goes, because we have such an outsized influence globally. So I really worry about not moving fast enough to deal with climate change. And I really worry about a country where people's rights are eroded, where the rule of law is eroded. We work every day at Earth Justice on the premise that we have laws to enforce and that we'll have fair courts and that our government will actually serve us. And there's some things that only your government can do for you. You know, the choices that you and I make can't just clean up the air or prevent our kids from getting poisoned. And I don't think that we're going to get to a healing planet without justice for people. And that is not the worldview that now President-elect Trump campaigned on. And so I really worry about what the next 4 years will be. And I'm glad that I have a job where I have something to do about it, or otherwise I'd be having a hard time getting out of bed these days.
Yeah. Yes, I hear you there. And you've been in this situation before, and we'll get into that in a minute, what some of the experience in the past has taught. So with this election outcome, many environmentalists are now looking to the states to protect what the federal government may not do anymore. California, for example, has had a waiver that has enabled it to have stricter regulations on air pollution than the federal standards. And because of California's huge size as a market and influence, those waivers allow other states to follow California's lead. And we've seen that happen. How do you see those waivers being challenged and defended right now?
So whenever the EPA grants California a waiver to have these standards that other states can uptake, industry always challenges them. But the law is very clear that if California meets basic standards under the Clean Air Act, EPA must approve the waivers. And so the waivers have generally stood. Right now, we have a lot of litigation making its way through the courts on the latest suite of standards that California has put forward. And they are foundational to climate progress. If we were thinking about what the prospects would be 10 years ago, I feel very confident about California's leadership going forward. Make no mistake, I still do, but we're dealing with different courts and we're dealing with a much more aggressive federal government that will be trying to tear down state leadership rather than to go with what Congress intended back in the 70s.
Right. And this is one of the sort of changes this time around. I think that the first time the perception and appearance of what happened in the first Trump administration was that there was a lot of chaos and that that actually got in the way of their ability to execute some of the things they wanted to do. This time, with Project 2025, with kind of an expectation of a win from the Republicans, I think it's going to be a different administration. And I'm wondering how you view that. I mean, are you prepared for a more aggressive day one, let's get after it type of thing?
We're really in the mode of we'll see. So on the one hand, the biggest ideas that the Trump team has put forward with respect to climate and the environment are dramatic increases in oil and gas drilling and export. That's kind of the one big affirmative policy that's been announced. And the rest is about gutting agencies, firing big swaths of federal employees, going after scientists and science in general. To execute on big ideas, shifting very big federal agencies and federal programs, that takes concerted work. It takes people who understand government, and it actually takes having some people in government who are laser focused on that. When you appoint someone like Lee Zeldin to be the head of the EPA, who has no experience running a big thing, doesn't know the agency, doesn't know its programs, doesn't understand its unions, I think you're going more for a chaos strategy than an execution strategy. So chaos works. It slows down government. If you starve government, if you chase the good people out of agencies, you're not going to get the kind of government protections that people need, but you are effectively shrinking government. So that's one way to go. But if you really want to make big moves, you can't do it with a chaos strategy. You actually need people to work on it. So my answer to your question is, we'll see. We are prepared to be suing EPA if they get in some experienced personnel who want to gut all of our statutes, protections, who want to be going after EPA staff. But in the event it's chaos, that's a playbook we know very well how to deal with, because there are laws against chaotic government. And that's where courts can step in. Even ideological judges don't like chaos.
After the break, we'll hear more from Earth Justice President Abigail Dillon on climate cases brought by young people.
Many people have been rightly inspired by these cases that are being brought by young people to defend their future, who are saying they have a constitutional right to live on a planet that has a healthy climate.
That's ahead when Climate One continues.
We're always trying to get more people talking about climate. You can help others find our show and learn more about climate by leaving us a review or a rating. Thanks for your support. During the first Trump administration, Senate Leader Mitch McConnell approved 234 judicial nominees, including three to the Supreme Court. That had a significant effect on the ideology of the federal judiciary, especially the Supreme Court, where conservatives hold a 6-3 majority.
We're changing the federal courts forever. Nobody's done more to change the court system in the history of our country than Donald Trump. We're going to keep on doing it. My motto is leave no vacancy behind.
Even with a conservative judiciary, Earth Justice President Abigail Dillon says her organization has been successful in defending the environment and climate.
The way in which the Trump administration was operating was so out of bounds that we were able to get the courts to take action fairly quickly in the most egregious instances. We were winning by far the majority of our cases. So far, our win rate is 85%. And I say so far because some of those cases are still going on. But even when we found ourselves before new Trump-appointed judges, we won many of our cases because the MO was so lawless. So the courts have changed significantly. We have even more judges who have been selected for their ideological views that will serve a Trump administration. We have a Supreme Court that sent a very strong signal to those judges that they can decide, that they don't have to defer to the federal government, that they can make bolder moves to deregulate and do away with protections that we all depend upon, and they don't have to fear so much reversal in some of the appellate courts. That said, I'd like to give some comfort to everyone who's listening and worried about whether we have fair courts. The Biden administration and Leader Schumer in the Senate really prioritized judicial appointments, and those appointments were about making sure that we had judges who believe in the role of government, who believe in the role of science. We have a lot of good judges in the lower courts and appellate courts, and it's important to remember that the Supreme Court cannot take every case. In fact, it takes a very tiny minority of cases every year.
That's a good way to frame it. One thing that's active now is a request to the Supreme Court to shut down state law claims against the fossil fuel majors for damages. Can you tell us a bit about how that's playing out? And do we expect that to change at all with the new administration, or is that on its own timeline?
Yeah. So just to pull back for a moment, there are many cases going on across the country where cities, municipalities are suing. You said the carbon majors, which is a great way to frame it. It's the companies who together have been responsible for the vast majority of greenhouse gas emissions. These are the big oil companies like
ExxonMobil, Shell, BP.
Exactly. And now that the science of climate attribution has advanced so much, we know that these companies are disproportionately responsible for climate change. And we also know that they have been lying about climate change and the role that their product, oil, plays in advancing climate change. And so there are many state law suits that cities are bringing saying, you lied, you're a nuisance, you are promulgating disinformation, and you're liable under state law for damages. And we would like you to pay up for the damage that we're paying for from climate change. This is a very powerful strategy. What we're wondering as a society is who's going to pay for these climate disasters? Who's going to pay to keep us safe? Who's going to pay for new insurance as we're in an insurance crisis? And these lawsuits may provide an answer. Of course, the industry has been fighting them tooth and nail, and they have wanted to make the case that federal law precludes, or in the legal term, preempts these state law suits. They're saying that the Clean Air Act occupies the whole space when it comes to pollution that's driving climate change. And there are really great arguments that that's not true. These cases aren't about interstate pollution. They're about fraudulent advertising. They're about disinformation. They're about nuisance. That should be in the province of the states. There's a case that's making its way, has gone all the way up to the Hawaii Supreme Court. It's a case brought by the city of Honolulu. My friends Vic Scher and Matt Edling are bringing this case, and they're about to really test what the courts will do in terms of finding damages. But there is now a request that the Supreme Court intervene, and the argument is this federal preemption argument. And as we speak, we're wondering what the Solicitor General under the Biden administration will do in the way of filings. And if that positioning is left to a next administration, we can imagine that the position will be very different under a Trump administration than under a Biden administration. And of course, we're wondering what the Supreme Court will do. I don't want to overstate that this is a hard question. It's not. It's an easy question. These are clearly state law claims, and the Supreme Court should not be getting in there. But there's so much at stake for the fossil fuel industry. We'll see.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So Let's go back a bit to what President-elect Trump plans to do once he's in office. He's spoken repeatedly about his desire to, you know, drill, baby, drill, to unleash, quote unquote, American energy dominance by really expanding oil and gas activity. He's announced his intended appointment of Doug Burgum for Interior Secretary. What does that agenda mean for public lands in the U.S.? How much of that do we expect to happen on lands that are a public resource?
It's really frightening. This is an area where a president has so much power. And it really matters whether the U.S. is doubling down on its role in the oil and gas business. It really matters for cherished public lands. It also really matters for the waters off of our coasts. A lot of this is offshore drilling as well. We've at Earth Justice really been successful in holding the line against new oil and gas leasing. Clients over the last 10 years or more, we have been pushing so hard on the Department of Interior and saw in this administration a really important pivot. The five-year plan that we have in place now for offshore drilling has gone from 40 lease sales on average to only 3 contemplated over the next 5 years. That is the direction we have to be moving, both to protect our lands. We are the biggest oil and gas producer in the world. The federal government has to shift direction on that. And we have to send a signal globally that it's possible to keep oil and gas assets unburned, right? If the U.S. doesn't do it, who will? And so I'm extremely worried about this drill, baby, drill agenda, because it's hard to stop. It's very much in the president's power. And it's very important that Congress not act to entrench our laws to demand that kind of extraction on our public lands going forward.
Let's go back to one other positive place where there's change, which is the states. And you mentioned Hawaii and the case that's being worked through there. What's another example of cases being handled in states that could have really far-reaching positive implications?
Let me give you one example in Hawaii again, and then let me give you an example of the broader strategy that's working all around the country, even in the reddest of red states. So the Hawaii example is, I think many people have been rightly inspired by these cases that are being brought by young people to defend their future, who are saying they have a constitutional right to live on a planet that has a healthy climate. In Hawaii, there is such a constitutional right in the state constitution, and there is this idea of a public trust that a state holds all of our environmental resources in trust for all of us. And young people brought such a smart case that we were privileged to litigate with our Children's Trust that said in Hawaii, it's the transportation system that is the biggest contributor to climate change. These are kids who've been through catastrophic flooding, who've lost homes in the Maui wildfires. They have every right to be before the courts demanding that their government do better. And in this case, ultimately, the Hawaii Department of Transportation was willing to settle with our plaintiffs and agree to a game plan that will get to zero emissions transportation in Hawaii on a binding schedule.
Amazing.
It's amazing. And in Hawaii, as in so many states, the Department of Transportation is a state-controlled entity. It is largely a state-funded entity. And around the country, what we're seeing is kind of a failure of vision, ideas, a blueprint for how you get to where we need to go on transportation, which is the lion's share of greenhouse gas emissions all across our country. So in Hawaii, you have this really smart head of the Department of Transportation who has now enshrined in a binding settlement a roadmap that's applicable all around the country. So the states that want to make progress now have a model for doing so. And, you know, it's more expensive. It's harder to do things in Hawaii. So if you can do it there, you can do it anywhere. So that's Hawaii. So can I give you a few lines on our public utility commissions?
Yes. These are, well, let's just say, in case listeners aren't aware, these are tremendously important and often overlooked or misunderstood entities that regulate lots of things at the state level, predominantly, electricity generation, transmission, things like that.
I even like to think, not like to think, I think they're invisible to most people.
Yeah.
You know, we just turn on a light switch. We don't think about where our energy comes from, much less who decides. But that happens at public utility commissions in every state. And so when Trump says, drill, baby, drill, that's his power over our energy mix. But where we get our electricity from, how renewables prosper in our economy, that's left to decisions that are made in trial-type proceedings in 50 states around the country. And the decisions are based on what's most economic, what's most affordable for customers. Gas and coal and, goodness forbid, oil cannot compete in the power markets with wind and solar and batteries. They just can't. And so, especially with some of the tax credits that were added into the IRA, the economic calculus for going to renewables is so strong. And we're able to go into these public utility commissions, into these lawsuits, basically, and make the case for the most affordable energy. We're also able to say unfair competition that is locking customers into more expensive energy from old gas plants, new billion-dollar gas plants. You cannot have anti-competitive provisions like this. So we're able to also tear down the barriers in a system that was made for fossil fuels so that clean energy can run faster. That's how we continue to make progress during the last Trump administration. We're going to be able to make even faster progress now because the clean energy industry is so much stronger. They're ready to go.
Abigail Dillon is president of Earth Justice. Thank you so much for being on Climate One. We'll have you back again soon, hopefully.
I appreciate being here so much. Thank you for all you do.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll go from the courts to Congress to take a look at the fate of Biden-era laws like the Inflation Reduction Act.
I'll point to the 18 Republican members who signed a letter to Speaker Mike Johnson saying, hey, don't throw the IRA baby out with the bathwater. These tax credits have merit, and let's have a thoughtful discussion about that.
That's up next when Climate One continues.
This is Climate One. I'm Greg Dalton.
And I'm Arianna Brocious.
In January, the Republicans will control the White House and Congress. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court has a 6-3 conservative majority, so you could say they control all three branches of government. We covered two so far, the executive and the judicial. Now let's take a look at the other branch, Congress.
In the Senate, Republicans will have a 53-47 majority. Pretty decisive. But in the House, they will have a razor-thin majority. Those slim margins mean compromise will be a big part of the next legislative session.
One of the few groups working to get conservative members of Congress to take on climate issues is Citizens for Responsible Energy Solutions, or CRESS. I invited CRESS President Heather Reams back on the show to get a sense of where climate and energy policy stands in the new Republican Congress.
All's not lost. Let me just tell you that right now. I know there's a lot of concern about what's going to happen with climate action. There's a couple things that give me some hope. One is the fact that permitting reform is going to get done. Well, permitting reform is holding up clean energy. It's driving up the cost of clean energy because we're not getting the projects going in a quickly enough. And there's also oftentimes litigation that can drag out for, you know, a decade or more. So permitting reform is going to happen. It's going to have guardrails to continue to protect the environment, but it's going to create more certainty for businesses, particularly clean technologies, to be able to deploy more quickly so we can get clean energy on the grid. So I think that's like the number one thing that can happen, whether that's in this Congress, which is the lame duck, the end of this Congress, or starting in the next Congress in 2025.
Yeah, and that means that there's a lot of wind and solar ready to be connected, but it can't get the wires to connect the wind and solar from where it's generated to what's called the load centers, the population, the cities where that is needed. And that's been a big problem. Also, that could open up a lot of more oil and gas as well. So you think that's going to be an okay net favorable balance, that it won't permitting reform won't unleash more dirty than clean energy?
Well, you know, a lot of my friends who are working in clean energy say, open it up. We want to compete. We are going to win, and we know we're going to win. So go ahead and open it up. Build the pipes. Give us the wires. We need a lot of American homegrown energy. Let's make it happen. We want to unleash what we can do. We want to really demonstrate what we can do. You know, just give them a chance. So I think permitting reform is an awesome opportunity for us. Another one I'll give you is nuclear. And the idea of strong, firm baseload power 24/7, as you know, we've brought back online a number of nuclear power facilities because we need that power to fuel our growing and advancing economy.
Though this country has not built a new nuclear power plant on time, on budget in a long time, the most recent ones went, $18 billion over budget. Consumers and perhaps some investors got stuck with that cost overrun. So I'm curious why you're so confident on nuclear when the industry hasn't delivered. The price of nuclear has been going up. The price of many other energy sources have been going down.
Well, I'm looking for an area of bipartisanship, and I think nuclear has that. The second piece is that the nuclear industry itself wants to streamline. They want to work with the government to make sure that nuclear is safe, the waste is stored properly. And there's just a lot of positive movement for that. So, no, I'm certainly not saying, Greg, that we're going to wave a magic wand and the nuclear is going to be inexpensive and everywhere. But I think it's a great area of bipartisanship.
You wrote that this was a good election for the future of clean energy, noting victories of Republicans like John Curtis of Utah, who's now moving from the House to the Senate to take the seat formerly held by Mitt Romney. John's been on our show a couple of times. Love talking to him about energy and his upgraded house and all sorts of things, impact on the outdoor and winter sports industries there in Utah. So there are some wins, but overall the tone seems to be, you know, pretty skeptical of anything that's that clean energy. So if you're looking at the people who are elected and now in power, particularly in the cabinet, a lot of fossil fuels pretty strongly and a lot of skepticism about climate. So how do you feel about that aspect of it?
Well, this goes to my overall outlook about how we tackle the climate crisis, that it is a bipartisan issue. It is not just an American issue. It's an international issue. And we need everyone at the table working together. So when you're pointing out the fact that there is someone who may be running the Department of Energy who has a fossil fuel background, it doesn't mean he or she, in this case, a he, is not in favor of all the above. Wants to see wind, solar, hydropower, nuclear, and all those other pieces. So what CREST is trying to do in my organization is educate Republicans, but really the public, about how working together is so important. Not one party, much less one nation, is going to solve the climate crisis. We need everyone working together. Now, you may have listeners who say, we cannot have any more fossil fuels. They can't happen. And if anyone who brings any more in line is a problem. And to those people who say that, I'll say, if we displace coal and then replace it with natural gas, say in India or any of these developing nations, we are going to reduce emissions. just like we did in the United States with a 21-point drop in emissions. It was significant for us. It can be significant in the next decade for those developing nations. And then we continue the energy transition to other cleaner forms of energy. But you can't blame a country for wanting power today, right, for their citizens. So I think this is a walk. And I think Republicans, particularly those that are coming into the Trump administration, understand that, or they're starting to understand that. And believe me, they will understand it once we start talking to them.
Right. And one organization is the Conservative Climate Caucus, which I think is in the House. John Curtis of Utah used to chair that. And they are members that it's an education forum. They go on field trips, but they don't endorse any specific legislation. So they don't do the really hard stuff, which is, are you for or against this particular language, this particular bill? What does that say about where we are, where is that we're kind of at that, you know, soft education place and not like, let's write bills and get things done?
Well, I think that's starting to change, too. They wanted to start the caucus and have an open policy. Come in, learn, come see things, hear from leaders from both sides of the aisle, hear from industry about what it means, why companies, for instance, are choosing a net zero goal. You know, it isn't, they're making a profit on this, right? There's a business decision there. So it's helping Republicans understand that this isn't about government mandates. This is about what's good for business. It's also what's good for the planet, right? So I think that that's been going on. Although we're going to have a whole new group of members that are starting in the new Congress, we're going to have to educate. But I think there are enough members where we can start to create and kind of like mini caucuses among the caucus, a cadre of members who are going to sign letters, decide to vote on bills. And I'll point to the 18 Republican members who signed a letter to Speaker Mike Johnson saying, hey, don't throw the IRA baby out with the bathwater. These tax credits have merit, and let's have a thoughtful discussion about that. So we're starting to see how this caucus and the Bipartisan Climate Solutions Caucus can be helpful in pushing an agenda for Republicans in climate.
Right. And part of the focus of that letter from sort of Republicans and sort of swing districts, moderate members, was please protect part of the Inflation Reduction Act, President Biden's, you know, keystone climate law. And that had all sorts of incentives. It was largely tax policy. There wasn't many mandates, many more carrots than sticks. Lots of Republican ideas in there, and honestly, put in there by Joe Manchin. It's incentives for money into projects, incentives for energy out of projects, incentives for people buying EVs and heat pumps. So what do you think is going to be protected, and what do you think is going to be rolled back? We certainly hear a lot about the EV $7,500 federal tax credit as being on the chopping block.
For sure. Now, because it was a partisan process, the Republicans don't feel like they have, quote, skin in the game. But you rightly point out that a vast majority of the investments that are happening are going to Republican districts, and members in those districts understand that those investments are there, and we're making the case to them every day to be able to protect those tax credits. So one of the criticisms you brought up, the 30D tax credit, which is the $7,500 rebate, if you were a tax credit you get for buying an EV, it's an expensive tax credit as tax credits go. And are we reducing emissions enough for the money that the Treasury is putting out, versus do we use that same pot of money and put it towards another tax credit? I'm not saying heat pumps, but for instance, something else that could help lower emissions too.
Right. But it's also, these are looked at as pay for, go help for pay to extend the corporate and individual income tax cuts that happened in 2017.
There's definitely talk of this is a pay for the Trump tax package from 2017. You're right about that too. But, you know, Republicans are willing to champion tax policies that are going to spur economic growth at the end of the day. So you don't necessarily need to pay for every single tax credit if they're spurring investment, which the IRA is. And we can show that. We have the data right now to be able to demonstrate that a lot of these tax credits don't need addition, you know, to be paid for in certain ways. I think there's a case to be made. I mean, even Senate Finance Committee Chairman or incoming Chairman Crapo had said he wants pro-growth policies And he's a bit at odds with what the House is talking about doing. So there is not one way of thinking about this from Republicans, but there is concern about the debt and how we balance all the things that President Trump said on the campaign trail, all the tax credits and things that he's promising versus the IRA tax credits as well. It's a lot of money, and I think this Congress has its work cut out for him.
Exxon CEO Darren Woods recently encouraged the U.S. to stay in the Paris Climate Agreement because it provides business certainty. He also said the need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions is not going away. What do you make of his comments, and what impact will his and similar voices have on policy? Traditionally, you know, Republican administrations listen to the Chamber of Commerce and the sort of establishment corporations like ExxonMobil.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a sign of the times when you're having Darren Woods, like head of Exxon, saying, look, stay in Paris. We're reducing emissions because it is part of their business plan now. And most, any company that I'm working with, Fortune, I'll even go to say Fortune 500 companies, are all having some kind of emissions reduction, ESG goals, and whatnot. This is not anything now that is flipping from one administration to the other or one political spectrum to the other. It's what corporate America is doing. Wall Street's figured this out. Main Street has figured this out in terms of reducing emissions. Pennsylvania Avenue still hasn't figured this out. And that's the work that's got to get done. And I think the education, this is why a caucus is helpful. This is why when you're a new administration, we're very excited about getting in and talking to those in the new administration. Like, there's a lot going on here. Did you know? Don't forget, you know, Trump was president, you know, a cycle ago, right? Or 4 years ago. The world has changed. Energy prices have changed. Technology has skyrocketed. It continues to grow exponentially. So there's a lot of education there we'll need to do. We're also not dealing with the same cabinet members, nominees that we saw before too. This is a new crop of people. So maybe this is new thinking, bringing in Governor Doug Burgum from North Dakota and creating a national energy council to really look at our energy and figure out how we produce more of it, how we produce it cleanly, how we export it. I think these are things that are all on the table, and they're going to want input from the public. So I'm looking forward to getting in there and talking about the amazing case of clean energy and what it can bring to our country.
Elon Musk helped Donald Trump get elected and is shaping his team and policies. He runs a company that sells EVs, solar panels, and battery storage. I have two of those three from that company. What are you looking for to see how Musk's commitment to EVs takes hold in the emerging administration? It's not yet clear whether or how that's going to play out.
Well, I think this is an excellent example. The Elon Musk / Tesla model is an excellent example of when President Trump has someone in his ear where he listens and he gets educated. He may, you know, release that tight grip of no, like, I don't want this, and has an ability to educate, like, whoa, the world is changing. I didn't know this was such cool technology. I think that Elon Musk also was kind of igniting and exciting part of what can be next, right? How it's going to improve our lives. And the federal government does have a role and facilitating innovation and at times funding some of the early stage innovations.
So you think that there can be innovation and the policy ought to be to help American jobs, American supply chain. And does that mean that there should be tariffs on Chinese imports? Because, you know, tariffs could be protective or inflationary. So it's, you know, I'm hearing the new administration say, we don't want subsidies. Oh, but we do want tariffs to kind of protect the different forms of protection and favoritism, right?
Yep, yeah, definitely. You're hearing from the Republican Party is fairly split on this. It's not split evenly either on whether or not tariffs are another tax. So Republicans usually don't see a tax they like, right? So if we're talking about increasing costs, there is a way to leverage tariffs to be able to incent more manufacturing in the United States. But what economists would often say is that it will ultimately be passed down to the consumer. Now, there's also not necessarily a tax, but really a carbon intensity that we should be looking at. If you're looking at widget A and widget A being built in China, widget B being built in the United States, and it's cleaner, done cleanly, more cleanly in the United States, but the premium is more, right? Then what should we be purchasing? You know, the federal government has tried to do this in procurement as well, but we could extend that. we need to understand the carbon intensity of products. Just kind of like how we see calories when we go to a Subway. And you're like, you know, I'm going to get the tuna because it's fish and it's good. But then you're like, oh, wait, I just need to get the turkey because the tuna is not healthy either when I look at the calories. Kind of the same thing with carbon emissions, too. We don't realize that the cement we're getting, maybe getting it cheaper from China, but we're paying for it in emissions.
Right. That mayonnaise and the tuna is this. Yeah.
Gets so me seeing every that is quite. Time.
Yeah. If we had that kind of calorie counters for carbon emissions on kind of at the consumer level.
Come on. I would choose something different. I think a lot of people would too. So that transparency is powerful.
Heather Reams, thank you so much for sharing your insights. President of Citizens for Responsible Energy Solutions. Thanks, Heather.
Thank you, Greg.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. We have a huge archive of all kinds of episodes on environment and energy and climate policy, and you can find them on whatever podcast app you use or on our website, climateone.org. And if you like this episode or one like it, send it to a friend so we can have more people having engaging climate conversations.
Our team includes Brad Marshland, Jenny Park, Ariana Brocious, Austin Cologne, Megan Basilia, and Ben Testani. Our theme music is by George Young. I'm Greg Dalton.